The audible of the best in Bitcoin. This is the Cryptoconomy. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. We are just before the halving. It is right around the corner. I hope you guys have started stacking with swanbitcoin.com/guy. Put that guy on the end of there, and they will know that I am the one that sent you. But we are, when this episode gets released, like a day and a half, 2 days away. So super exciting. And with that, I kind of want to talk about the halving today. And there is a little piece released at the end of February that I really enjoyed by a new author on the show, Dominique Strukal. I hope that's how I say the name. It's from Satoshi Labs, though, the guys behind the Trezor and, you know, well, a bunch of stuff. But I'm sure you guys know Satoshi Labs. And this is posted on their Medium page. And it's titled, "The Economics of Bitcoin Halving. What will happen to the price of Bitcoin?" And this, it pushes back a bit on the stock-to-flow model, and I want to give where I think they're right and where I think they're wrong, and then really dig into my take on this piece afterward, and of course, the halving. Quick heads up, this was February 20th that this was posted, so this is actually before the massive dump in the liquidity crisis that we had and have since recovered from. Okay. The economics of the Bitcoin halving. Bitcoin is circling $10,000 again. And of course, you are wondering what will happen next. 2020 is a special year for Bitcoin in many ways. One of them is even written by Satoshi himself into its DNA. Yes, the halving. The next Bitcoin halving is estimated to occur on May 12th, 2020, so let's take a closer look at what will happen afterwards. There are many theories about what halving does to the price of Bitcoin, and most have some reasonable basis in economics. Although they often do not speak about it explicitly, they point to changes in the supply and demand side. Economists like this simple model. If we expect a decrease in supply or an increase in demand, Bitcoin should grow. Let's together economically dive into the halving and see why Bitcoin should, or shouldn't, rise to new all-time highs. Supply. Bitcoin inflation falls to 1.8%. That's the whole principle of halving. Instead of 12.5 Bitcoin, the reward miners receive for solving block calculations is halved in May 2020 to 6.25 Bitcoin. Only about 900 coins will be created every day instead of the current 1,800. The annual increase to the total money supply will thus fall by more than half to 1.8%. To compare it with something we know better, in 2019, money supply growth in the United States was 5.15%. Over the past 50 years, the US dollar has managed to fall below 2% only in 1993 and 1994. Of course, someone may argue that many bitcoins are lost, so inflation is actually higher. If all the lost or unspendable bitcoins represent 1/5 of the overall supply, the actual bitcoin inflation is around 2.25%. That would change almost nothing in comparison to the US dollar. We would just have to add 1 year on each side of 1993 and 94, meaning 92 and 95, where dollar inflation was lower than 2.25%. In other words, Bitcoin already has little monetary inflation, which will drop even further. And what does it mean economically? Fewer new Bitcoins mean reducing supply growth. Miners now spend part of their newly mined bitcoins or send them to exchanges to be able to pay for electricity and other costs. Buyers will fight for fewer bitcoins, and at the current demand, it should drive the price up. This was the case with the last two Bitcoin halvings, and that is why many people cannot wait for the next to come on May 12th, But of course, it is not so easy to predict the effect of halving on the price of Bitcoin. That's when basic economics can come to the rescue. Supply. Forget stock to flow. More than a year before the third halving, all the Bitcoin fans were challenged by a Plan B article, which anticipated that the next halving would drive the price up to $90,000. Mathematically, the model looked convincing, and the idea behind it was also impressive. The smaller the flow of new money to the total stock, the rarer the commodity. The more unique the commodity, the higher the price. And with halving, the scarcity measured by this stock-to-flow model will increase dramatically. Is it possible to predict the price of Bitcoin like this? It would clearly deserve its own article, but let's just try it briefly. No need to beat around the bush. Using stock-to-flow to predict prices is absolute nonsense. First, the price is the result of supply and demand. Looking at the supply is certainly useful, but without demand, we simply cannot find the price. If the demand for Bitcoin falls, the price will drop even at the same stock-to-flow. After all, just look at Bitcoin Cash and you immediately see that the model does not work. Or make your own cryptocurrency with 10 times the stock-to-flow of Bitcoin. It will probably be worthless because there will be no demand for it. Second, if we knew Bitcoin had to moon because of the magical stock-to-flow and shoot up 10 times with every halving, why aren't we there yet? Are speculators so irrational? But probably you can defend it, as it is way too risky, which Plan B did. Thirdly, in a few decades, according to the stock-to-flow model, the value of Bitcoin should be higher than the GDP of all countries in the world. And as soon as there are the same amount and then fewer new coins created than there are lost, the model predicts an infinite and then a negative price of Bitcoin. Scarcity is a necessary but not sufficient condition of value. The stock-to-flow model correctly draws attention to scarcity, but omits the second necessary variable from that equation. As a result, it is unusable to predict the price, and remains just a wish of all Bitcoin fans. Demand. Halving attracts attention. There is no historical necessity. People tend to use history to predict the future and believe that there are repetitive cycles. Of course, there is no such thing, but interesting is the very fact that people believe in it. As a result, repetitive history sometimes becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. In short, the expectations associated with Bitcoin halving attract attention, which helps to meet those expectations. Indeed, this article is proof of that. We speak, write, and lecture about the halving. If it nudges the indecisive to try Bitcoin, the halving itself will increase demand and, consequently, the price. Demand. But for some, only temporarily. Not everybody is attracted by Bitcoin's technical and economic characteristics. It is healthy to admit that many people are just looking for a place to get rich quick. There's nothing wrong with that, and it happens at all possible markets. With their own money, speculators risk to correctly estimate the future price and provide the market with an important information function. Thanks to them, the current price carries information about the future expectations of those who actually have the skin in the game. However, the market price is continually changing, and the upward movement attracts more and more people to the market. As with any asset, there are unreasonable short-term expectations that inflate bubbles that later burst. Historically, in a relatively short time after the previous two Bitcoin halvings, the bubbles were inflated. After the first of 2012, the price of Bitcoin grew 100x in only a year. After the second in 2016, it took Bitcoin a year and a half to increase the price 30x. In both cases, Bitcoin exceeded the symbolic thresholds, first $1,000 and then $10,000. However, in both cases, it collapsed from its peaks and lost approximately 85% of the value. We are prone to bubbles. But is there anything that follows from it for the future? Unfortunately, no. It seems tempting, but taking two points and trying to approximate them to the future would be extremely irresponsible. Demand. Are markets efficient? But even if it all makes sense to you, one thing brings chaos to it. If we know almost precisely when the halving will happen, then it should not be difficult to prepare for it. Speculators aren't foolish, and this would be an opportunity they wouldn't miss. In the past, we might be tempted to explain that they were unaware of Bitcoin, but in 2020, this is untenable. Economists call it the efficient market hypothesis. Any known information should already be included in the price. But do markets behave like that in reality? Well, more than we would expect. Much of the growth from the last bottom that Bitcoin found, slightly above $3,200 at the end of 2018, can undoubtedly be explained by the expectations of increased attention before the approaching halving. So, if you expect a sharp increase in Bitcoin value immediately after the halving, adjust it downwards according to how much you believe others are expecting the same. And try to separate for yourself the people who know about the real and immediate effect of halving on the supply and demand from those who will only temporarily jump in due to price increases. Of course, markets are not fully efficient, and no one thinks that. Especially for such risky assets where there is, in fact, a marvelous asset on the one hand, but on the other hand, an unpredictable government, fierce competition, unremitting fraudsters, and many other risks. At any time, there is a constant reassessment not only of risks, but also of opportunities, and with it, the price. Supply and demand, a place for optimism. The recipe for Bitcoin's long-term success is not waiting for halving after halving. It is in reducing existing risks, seeking new opportunities, and patiently explaining the existing risks and opportunities. There is optimism in all this because Bitcoin can offer much more now than before the first or the second halving. It seems almost unbelievable, but let's remember that before the last halving, for example, there was no SegWit yet. And just imagine there was no safe way of holding Bitcoin. Trezor didn't even exist before the first halving. Expectations of what happens after the halving are supported by both supply and demand. Limited supply is a necessary but not sufficient condition for the price increase. The next Bitcoin halving is a natural demand stimulus that has the potential to inflate a bubble, unless the general public realizes that it has changed beyond recognition since the last halving. And it has changed for the better. And this was an opinion piece from Dominique Strahlkall, I believe. Let's go ahead and hit our sponsor really quick, because I really want to talk about this and where I think there's some really good points, but where I actually think I want to disagree with some of this, and I want to lay out my argument as to why. So let's go ahead and hit our sponsor, and then we will jump back in and do a little guy's take on this one. All right, so I really enjoyed this piece, if anybody who's listened to this show for any length of time, listened to the Nick Carter piece about the efficient market hypothesis, actually pieces, about that, and then same with 100 trillion USD Plan B's both first breakdown of the stock to flow and then essentially defense of it against the efficient market hypothesis. Anybody who's listened to both of those, and I will have them in the show notes just so you can check it out, as well as my guy's take on this. I think the stock to flow is actually a really important model, and there's a number of different reasons why. But I love going back and forth because I feel like this is kind of one of those things that you can't really prove one way or the other. I think the model speaks for itself in the fact that it seems consistent over a very small subset of commodities with very important characteristics, like very key characteristics to the stock to flow idea. But I think any assessment as to why is just a guess. Like it's just, you know, an attempt to rationalize something that is incredibly complex and it's explicitly why I think the supply is so important, is because it's the simplest way to break down the consequences of an incredibly complex thing. Like, just saying, like, demand is in itself such an oversimplification of an aggregate of so many different things that in and of itself is not even a reliable thing to suggest. Like, demand is a combination of billions of things all at once. It includes speculation. It includes people trying to predict the future. It includes people having to go to an alternative or having to sell off for liquidity. It is such a broad, just in the idea of a price mechanism, the price is an information aggregator. It is accumulating as much knowledge as society can provide through the exchange function. All trade and exchange is being displayed in the price. And again, the price isn't even static. The price is something that doesn't really exist. It exists in 1,000 different areas all at once, and then there is essentially some version of an average or an aggregate of it that we just kind of simplify it down to. So it's simplifications on top of simplifications. So first off, is that this thing is so complex. That is why I think measuring supply is such an interesting thing, because it narrows it down to the one thing that we actually do know, that we actually can, and that's just the beauty of stock to flow for goods like silver and gold and platinum and all of these other goods that, again, have a very set of critical characteristics that are not consumable and seem to follow this same model, that seem to respond to whatever it is at the heart of the reality of a scarce supply and a useful good, whatever inherently is there, that the demand follows that. So I want to talk about why. So first we'll get into, first let's just talk about the halving. So this halving, Bitcoin is going to, just like they said in this article, Dominique said, is we are falling to about 1.8% inflation rate, down from, 3.6-ish right now, with 12.5 new Bitcoin per block to 6.25 Bitcoin per block. And this is actually my third halving now. And something that's really funny to me is, like, I've had so many conversations now, like, with the very first halving, the amount of FUD and people claiming minor death spiral and, like, a transaction, the inability for transaction. I mean, just every argument that you can think of right now that you have heard about why the halving is going to kill Bitcoin was there at the first one. And then it was there again at the second one. And I was kind of getting tired of it at the second one. The first one, admittedly, I was a little nervous. Bitcoin was still incredibly experimental. It was still a network. We'd actually just recently gone through a pretty bad fork, like a bug. They had to roll back, 23 blocks or something between 0.07 and 0.08 of the software. So, this still felt very fragile at the time. And admittedly, I was a little bit nervous. Like, it was cool because that was one of the things that really drew me to Bitcoin, was the idea of an incontestable, of a no one can change it, set in stone, predictable monetary policy. But actually going through a huge, deflationary step, essentially an order of magnitude step down in the inflation rate, and know that, miners are going to be paid less, that there's all these feedback loops. Like, it was a little nervous. There's a semi-rational idea of a quote-unquote miner death spiral, if you don't think about it too hard. But if you start to think about it, and that's kind of what I did at the time, is I would just read all the pros and the cons, like arguments or whatever. But in the end, I couldn't get around the fact that the difficulty adjustment is there explicitly for that. And we've seen mining power Come on the network, and we've seen it leave the network in huge swaths, both different directions, and it works fine. And all I could ever think is that not just the difficulty adjustment. Like, it's such a simple, like, there's no complexity to the difficulty adjustment. It is as beautifully simple as the 21 million limit is. And every single time, the only way that you can imagine the minor death spiral as being any sort of rational or logical conclusion to the halving is that the difficulty adjustment won't work, is that it just won't happen. And I think at this point it's kind of silly, particularly when we see exactly how many miners get washed out if the price drops by 80%. I mean, think about it. If the halving causes a 50% decline in revenue, but we have survived multiple 80%, 90% drops in the price, well, that is also an 80 or 90% drop in revenue. Why is the halving special? Like, wouldn't the mining death spiral happen when we went from $1,000 to $70 or whatever it is back in 2013? Like, isn't that exactly what we're talking about? The revenue, the ability to profit from your mining drops, and therefore you drop off the network, and therefore, you know, miners leave, it's less secure, people get scared, people drop their Bitcoin, blah, 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 death spiral all the way down to zero. Isn't that the argument? Why is it specific to how many Bitcoin are being paid out rather than the value of those Bitcoin? Because that's the important metric of that argument. And considering right now what you see from, you know, a month ago, we've already washed out all the weak hands in mining. Everybody who couldn't be profitable at 3,000 just had to deal with that again and cut off their miners. So we've been there, and now we've recovered, which is actually why I'm curious if we'll actually see a significant price drop after the halving or not. Because I feel like this quote-unquote run-up before the halving was more a recovery rather than an actual run-up. I mean, we were here. I mean, just like he starts off with this article. Remember, this was February 20th. This was a month and like 20 days ago. So getting close to 2 months ago, Bitcoin is circling $10,000. What are we doing right now? Circling $10,000. We haven't moved in the grand scheme of things. Like, when we look at the aggregate over this period of time, we've done very little movement. We've just been very volatile to get to the same place we started at. But the important part is that the inflation is getting cut in half. Now, obviously, and he's absolutely right about this, demand is the important factor of this equation. Supply is a known, predictable, and unchangeable factor. But we know the supply is being cut in half. Therefore, if the over time, the consistent demand into Bitcoin does not change, it means we will see a rise in the price. And I don't care how much you want to excuse that as being bullish and like being a Bitcoin fanboy, both of those things, with which I am, absolutely, you can dismiss that all day. But the explanation is not on me. What you have to do is explain why there is also going to be a 50% cut in demand. There's an important factor here, is that demand is a consequence of time. So let's actually go through these points here of, let's just talk about stock to flow right here and his reasons for, quote unquote, let's forget stock to flow. Okay, so first is that, what we just talked about is that this is supply and demand. So looking at the supply is useful, but without demand, we cannot find the price. Sure, but what's funny about that is that comparing it to an equilibrium price with supply is how we can actually judge what the demand is doing. And that's where the idea of co-integration comes in, is that when we are way overbought, the price has pressure to come back down because the inflation rate will not let it persist too far above. Remember, there is a degree of time here that is inescapable. And the efficient market hypothesis does not at all suggest that just because we know something is going to happen in 20 years, that we're going to, tomorrow morning, we're going to wake up and we're going to price that in. That is absolutely not what the efficient market hypothesis suggests. And you should never, ever, ever think that that is tradable data. Nobody uses the efficient market hypothesis to make a trade in the market. Now, his position for why he thinks the demand is the more important factor, he's actually got a really good example for this, is just look at Bitcoin Cash. So this is a good basis for the argument. And I really like this because this is showing that supply is not the important factor, is not the only factor here. And he's absolutely right. But it is the confidence in supply. It is the belief and the establishment in what the supply really is. And I think the important thing about Bitcoin Cash is that I don't buy it because I don't have the slightest clue what supply is. I don't know what the rules are. I don't think Bitcoin Cash is in any way an independent scarce good. They've broken their difficulty adjustment algorithm, the most beautiful part of Bitcoin, arguably, like 3 times. They hard fork every 6 months. They're a company that just changes with the winds. I do not in any sense consider that an independent, reliable, secure asset. I think that's the same. I think comparing Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash from the fundamental security of decentralization and around the mindset of an immutable, reliable, like independent monetary policy is as fundamentally different as comparing gold and seashells. And I don't think that's an exaggeration at all. I think all these altcoins are the worst examples. I think these are so different from each other in qualitative areas that you can't compare them. You can't compare them on supply. It's as different as a Google spreadsheet that supposedly has a limit to the number of columns they can put in it, and they promise they're not going to put any more columns in the spreadsheet, and Bitcoin. I genuinely do not see these things as scarce. And at the exact same time, we're talking about a monetary network. We're talking about a system of monetary value where one, by definition, outcompetes the other. Like they are antithetical to each other. So it would necessarily mean, and I think this is a condition of a monetary good, is that it will price independent of the others. Like it will be antithetical to the other. So the fact that Bitcoin Cash is plummeting and does not follow even close to the stock to flow is, I think, one of the reasons why Bitcoin does. Because it is the one that is seen as the secure, actually scarce digital good. The other ones are just digital things. There are a lot of digital things that are not scarce, and there is plenty of places that you can get a lack of assurances in digital scarcity and digital security. Those things will not capture value. If you do not have these assurances of scarcity and you do not have the assurances of stability and you do not have the assurances of security, then it's not a scarce digital good. End of story. So you can't compare Bitcoin with Bitcoin Cash for the same reason you can't compare the scarcity of gold with the scarcity of TVs. Of course, the scarcity of TVs may very well line up with an incredibly good stock-to-flow ratio at some point in its existence, like on some point in its manufacturing, where we're only manufacturing 1% of TVs for the stock of TVs on the market. But that does not mean that TVs will follow the stock-to-flow, because you could easily ramp up production of TVs. And I think in that same way, a digital thing runs 1,000 times the risk of just being printed, of just having that monetary policy or the fundamental consensus rules or the fundamental security of that thing changed arbitrarily, and therefore thinking of it as a stock to flow, as if the flow has any assurance whatsoever, is silly. And I think that's what the market is telling us. Okay, so second, that's just why I think altcoins, Bitcoin Cash, these things, these are not good examples of that. Now, before we move to the second one, to go back and just talk about demand, he says that if demand for Bitcoin falls, the price will drop, even if we're at the same stock to flow ratio. Of course, course. We see that all the time. Like, we just saw that a couple weeks ago. The price fell from 10,000 down to 3,000 because demand dropped. Because need for liquidity for alternative investments, for the need of using Bitcoin as a source of liquidity when liquidity dries up became available, and it outweighed the short-term demand for Bitcoin. But again, I think these are short-term demand problems, which leads me to, this is where we get to number two, is that second, if we knew Bitcoin had to moon because of the magical stock to flow, and it would shoot up 10 times every halving, why aren't we there yet? Now, I really like the framing of this question, because this is a good question to ask. But I think it is fundamentally ignorant of how markets work. There is not an infinite amount of capital to devote to Bitcoin at any one point in time. It doesn't exist. And to think that the efficient market hypothesis is actually, can somehow conjure up an infinite amount of resources in order to price the future in 20 years ahead of time, it's simply not going to work. Because, and in fact, I think these hype cycles are actually great examples of attempting to price in the future and then watching the inflation rate beat it back down to reality. Is that no matter what you do, the real inflation rate, if somebody sank in $5 billion into Bitcoin right now and shot the price up, for the next 4 years, it would be pushed back down by the amount of produced Bitcoin. It is only through sustained production, which takes time. It is a consequence of time. Time is a metric in that, of that is consistently moving into Bitcoin. It is consistent demand over time that is the important metric. A good example is, like, we talk about like incredibly high assurance markets. Use it for something that would price in is basically the example or the analogy that you would use to give us a good illustration or a demonstration of something that I think could apply here. So let's take something with incredibly high assurances and incredibly established market, and then think about what a supply shock would do to that. So the example, I was actually just chatting with Parker Lewis the other day. Awesome conversation. I'll have that out soon. So keep an ear out for that. But he was talking about, like, let's say there's a huge earthquake in Chile and all the copper mines, like let's say like the top five copper mines in the world that produce like 80% of the supply are all demolished. And we know for a fact that copper production is going to drop sharply in a very short amount of time. That supply, there's going to be a supply shock. Well, immediately, because of the assurances of that market, because we know that even for 30 years, there's been very little fluctuation, or we have an expected, an expected amount of fluctuation in copper that has been predictable for potentially centuries. Because of those level of assurances and that level of establishment in the market, we could price that in very quickly. Here's the important thing, is that reality is 3 weeks away. It's not 4 years. It's going to reflect in the market almost immediately, because the actual conditions, the reality of its scarcity, will be here in like a week or so. Now, if we knew that copper was going to be scarce in 4 years, that would not happen the same. There may be a temporary price spike, but the production would not stop, and it would continue pushing the price back down. And every single time the price pushed up, inflation would speed up a little bit. Production of copper would speed up just a tad. And again, push it back down. There's not an infinite amount of capital to price in every future that we know for every good and item in the universe. Like, we know a lot of things are probably going to happen in the future, but we can't price it all in because we haven't even made the capital necessary to actually invest in it. And again, back to my original point, is that what we need to ask about whether or not the price is going to go up or down or stay the same is if we think the consistent normal demand of Bitcoin that has kept it at a rough average of a price for the past 2 years, can you give me a good reason why that is going to suddenly drop by 50% and stay there? Because if not, the halving will affect the price. If you're saying that this is all speculation over the halving, speculation is short-lived. It is short time in the market. Why wouldn't they have bailed out when it dropped 80% just recently? I guess it's more like 60% or something like that. I can't remember exactly. But these are kind of fundamental things to, like, how far out we can price things. Speculators are great at pricing in things 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now, a month from now. But they do not have the capital available to price up. They're not pricing in things that are 10 years away, 5 years away. I can't think of any good example of that actually happening. And maybe it has happened in some incredibly established, super low risk markets. But I think just the day-to-day variability of all of the other things, of all the other risks, the fact that this is a novel commodity in and of itself, I think it just negates all of that. And we end up back in a place where it's relative scarcity and its relative baseline of demand, not the speculative fluff that we see all the time run its course. We see it run up to 12,000, 14,000, and then crash back down to 6, and then come back up to 9 and 10, and then crash all the way down to 3, and then come back up to 9 to 10. We see the effects of the speculation, and we see how short-lived those things are. Those, by necessity, that volatility, if you just look at it, doesn't price shit in 4 years from now. It lasts for weeks, months. Those are the time frames in which those things can be sustained. And at the end of the day, there is a baseline demand and a baseline long-term stable supply schedule that I think both of those together make up the difference between the average speculative fluff and the average production of the good, and that it causes pressure in both directions, up towards the scarcity, the inflation schedule of the good when it is lower, and down when it is higher. In the end, the one thing that can actually be measured objectively, that is non-subjective, that's another key thing to understand about this, is that demand is subjective. So there is only one objective measurement to make, and that is the scarcity, that is the supply schedule. And that is the only thing that will objectively have an effect on the market. Now, of course, if it is perceived that the scarcity is no longer reliable, that the assurances are no longer good, that it can no longer provide, or it could potentially not remain the same commodity as it is today a year from now, then demand would drop off like a rock. Demand would vanish overnight. But as long as that reality, that underlying confidence of what Bitcoin is, doesn't change, I don't think, unless somebody has an ungodly amount of capital, it's not possible to price in too distantly into the future. I mean, think about it. If, you know, that's what the hype bubbles are doing, like skyrocketing up to $10,000, $20,000, and then crashing back down, is let's price this in because in 20 years this is going to be so scarce it's unbelievable. And then reality, the actual inflation rate, slapping them and being like, calm the freak down, dude. We're not there yet. We got so much time. You are way overexcited about this. The reality, boots on the ground, actual production and exchanging of Bitcoin, the actual existence of supply in liquid capital markets, does not reflect what you hope or expect it to be in the future. And you are going to have to throw way more capital at it to actually get us there ahead of schedule. Not to mention that demand itself is a consequence of time. So even if we did suddenly have a 0% inflation rate and that was already part of the plan, it would still take 20 years for the demand to be realized in the price. and it would go through probably still a series of hype cycles. It's going to be an incredibly long process of maturation, and that's what I think we're seeing. And the fact is that demand, in attempting to price in the future, is trying to go against reality. That this is really the thing where speculators are becoming arrogant and thinking that they can predict the future, when the real reality, the right now facts of the matter, is that that's not the inflation schedule. And you should be putting your money in slowly over time, not buying it all in right now, because there's just not all the capital there to actually move it. But in the end, these are all feedback loops, right? Like I don't think those, regardless of my defense of it here, I don't think stock to flow is some, you know, magical power that it's just going to predict what the price is. Like, it is a reflexive model. It looks back at past prices in order to predict future based on the price of its past scarcity. So it's literally the lack of accuracy in its history alters the potential accuracy of its future. And again, price is subjective in and of itself. Like, demand is a subjective thing. So none of it is in any sort of an exact science in any sense of the words. So please don't get me wrong in what I'm trying to argue here. I'm simply trying to bring attention to the fact that there is a real reality of scarcity, and it is the only thing that can be concretely measured. And the stock-to-flow model is actually something that gives us the potential to see the gravity of a price, of a price equilibrium for goods that whose greatest section of demand is based on their reliable scarcity in and of itself as a store of value, as a monetary good. And Bitcoin falls into that. And there is a very small subset of other goods that do as well. They have very key characteristics that you can't really avoid. But for the things that they're so hard to find. You don't find them in TVs. You don't find them in anything that we can just really produce a lot of, whether or not it becomes scarce at one point or incredibly abundant later. It's in things that necessarily have some incredibly predictable inflation schedule or extreme restriction on its production, and has the key characteristics that make it a semi-monetary good. Platinum, gold, silver, these things actually are weirdly adherent to the stock to flow model. And I truly believe that this is because the supply is the most important factor in the consequent demand. Now, we could absolutely see in the short term a correction in the price downward after the halving. We've seen it the last couple of times, two. To be specific, there was a run-up pre-halving where everybody got overexcited and overzealous, and then it fell. But again, if long-term, that underlying basis of demand stays constant, then the price will begin to push up necessarily because of the lack of new supply to meet what was a stable demand. And all the speculative fluff is short-term and can be rightfully ignored in determining what the real demand of this good is. The speculative fluff is what happens in 3 weeks, not what happens in 3 years. What happens in 3 years is the reliable underlying demand of those who know that this is a long-term game and know that there is long-term scarcity, and they have already devoted their capital to it. And the more certain that future is, the more capital they will devote to it. So there's one more thing that I wanted to hit before we close this out. Everything else I agree with. I'm actually just focusing on a small section of this article of points with the stock to flow. So I'm actually kind of ignoring a lot of it just because this is what I find most fascinating. But the idea that the model has to break down because it predicts an infinite price. Now, he even says in this article that it would then go negative, but that's not true. I'm not sure where he got that impression that it would suggest a negative price of Bitcoin. It would just suggest a higher multiple of an infinite price, quote unquote. But this doesn't have anything to do with the idea that Bitcoin will be able to buy an infinite amount of resources, which I think this is the fundamental, like, incredibly hard to grasp framing of what we are comparing it to. Understand, there is no reasonable stock to flow model for dollars, because dollars are the pricing mechanism. Dollars have an infinite stock to flow, even though they're printed highly, because they became the pricing structure. Stock to flow only works in comparison to the pricing mechanism, to the totem by which we compare all of those things to. Everything is relative. So when stock to flow goes infinite, if Bitcoin continues to be the good and the commodity that we have, it becomes the reserve asset, it goes to infinity because it is now used as the thing to predict gold's stock to flow. It's the pricing mechanism. You can't run stock to flow on something that is your pricing totem. It's infinite because there's nothing to compare it to. It is the biggest thing. So, yes, the model may very well break down, but it will break down up if Bitcoin stays what it is. If it continues to work, if it continues to be the most secure and independent monetary good, and solely the most reliable in the digital space. And it will go infinite, not because one Bitcoin will buy the whole world's worth of goods, but because it won't make sense to compare it to anything. We will do the opposite. We will compare everything to it. So that is why I'm bullish. Anyway, I love this discussion. I don't want to, even though I feel like I was like angry arguing with Dominique during this, I don't want him to think that I was trying to trash his article. I really did enjoy this article, and I love these arguments. Bitcoin Cash, I think, is a great steel man attempt to show that it isn't the scarcity exactly, like the supply itself, that matters. And I think he's absolutely right that the importance of supply is still a function of demand, but that supply is still the only objective thing with which we can compare it to. And simply put, I think there is a powerful degree of truth in the stock-to-flow model that is going to be really hard to break away from, and that it is simply, there is a model to measure the real-world scarcity of something, and that its demand will attempt to account for that information as that reality, as we meet that reality. And that the speculative fluff, yes, the speculative fluff will try to price it in. That is why we have hype bubbles. That is why we have crashes. It's because that speculative fluff doesn't have an infinite amount of capital. All of this wealth needs to come from something else, and there are alternative things, there are more pressing, more immediate concerns, there are other goods that need to be liquidated, which take time, and specifically those goods have their own, you know, stock to flows, have their own current supply and production limitations, and no matter what you do, all you do, you're taking the price of 8 years, you're trading 8 years for the price difference, by making that judgment and taking that risk today, which means that necessarily you're only going to get an itty-bitty, tiny, nothing fraction of people who actually have the capacity to do that, to defer the alternatives and the actual production and the actual capital for that length of time in order to price in that future. So necessarily, we won't price it in 100%. We'll price it in like 1%, 2%, maybe. And I think at the end of the day, the real production and the reality of the real liquidity in the markets and the real capital available to direct toward this thing is what will dictate the price the longer you stretch this thing out over time. And that's why I really just think the stock-to-flow model is not simply to be casually dismissed. Oh, I'm tired. Okay. I'm out. I have prior obligations and lots of other stuff to work on. There are some amazing announcements coming soon. Bitcoin Audible is almost here, guys. Keep a very close eye out on it. And if you haven't seen the Twitter tag, @BitcoinAudible is live. So you can go check that out on Twitter. It's time to start following because something's happening soon. I feel like it might happen with the halving. Hopefully I can get my work done. That's why I'm going back to it, and I'm going to slam as hard as I can. But I have something to announce, multiple things to announce very soon, and I'm very happy. So make sure to subscribe to the show. Follow me on Twitter @TheCryptoEconomy and now @BitcoinAudible. And in the meantime, while we're getting ready for the halving and while we're moving into the third era of Bitcoin, make sure that you are stacking your sats regularly, that you have your Bitcoin savings plan at swanbitcoin.com/guy, and that you are stacking for the future. And with that, happy halving, everybody. I will see the rest of the crypto economy crew. We're going to have a big Zoom meeting, and we're going to have a whole lot of fun. I'm going to be trashed while this is happening, and I'll have just finished my panel with Value of Bitcoin Conference, so I'll be ready for a break and some time to celebrate, so I'll catch you guys over there. Everybody else, I love you all. Don't forget to subscribe, and until then, take it easy, guys.